Imagine you are responsible for a massive power generation plant. I mean, your actual day job is just keeping the lights on for millions of people.
Right. No pressure.
Exactly. No pressure at all. And to do that, you rely on these incredibly thick, heavy-duty steel components deep inside the facility. And these parts, they've been operating at a blistering 565 degrees Celsius for like 25 years.
Wow. Yeah, that is a long time for that kind of heat.
It really is. Every single day, they're just enduring this relentless physical stress and extreme temperatures. So the million-dollar question, the thing keeping you up at night is, how do you know exactly when one of those parts is going to fail before it triggers some catastrophic blowout?
It is a genuinely terrifying engineering problem. Because if you guess wrong and you just leave a degraded component in service, the consequences are disastrous.
Right, totally.
But on the flip side, if you play it too safe, like if you proactively replace everything years before you actually need to, you are just burning through millions of dollars in unnecessary downtime, materials, you name it. You need this incredibly precise timeline.
And usually, you know, we think of a thick slab of steel as just permanent. It's solid, it's heavy, it really doesn't look like it's doing anything at all.
Right. Looks completely inert.
Exactly. But today's deep dive is going to look right through that illusion. We are examining a really fascinating 1989 theoretical analysis by HKDH Padeshia. It's all about changes in cementite composition during the tempering of steel.
Which sounds super dense, but it's actually incredible.
It really is. Our mission today is to uncover how metallurgists can actually read the invisible thermal history that's locked inside the steel itself. We're going to talk about how predicting these tiny atomic movements within solid metal can prevent, you know, massive multi-million dollar industrial disasters.
Because metals are, well, they are anything but static.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the atomic level, they are this bustling, dynamic environment, especially when they're exposed to high heat over decades. By understanding how the internal chemistry of the steel shifts over time, we essentially uncover this microscopic black box.
A black box, really?
Yeah, it's a built-in record of every single degree of heat that metal has experienced since the day it was forged.
Okay, that is wild. So let's start with the physical threat that makes this microscopic black box so necessary in the first place. The real-world enemy we're fighting here is a phenomenon known as creep.
Right, creep. Creep deformation is pretty much the ultimate limiting factor for the life of high-temperature assemblies in the power generation industry.
So what exactly is happening to the metal?
Well, when you subject steel to immense mechanical stress and simultaneously hold it at very high temperatures, like that 565 degrees Celsius we're talking about, it doesn't just sit there. It undergoes a slow, continuous, permanent change in its physical shape.
So the metal is physically stretching out. It reminds me of, think about a beam of hard wax. Or like warm taffy spanning a gap.
Oh, that's a great way to picture it.
Right. Like if you leave it at room temperature, it holds just fine. But if you heat it up just a tiny bit over months, it imperceptibly bows and stretches until it finally just snaps.
Exactly. That physical stretching is the macroscopic result of what we call atomic slip. Entire planes of atoms are slowly sliding past one another under all that persistent stress and thermal energy.
Just sliding around in there.
Yeah. And what makes creep such a uniquely dangerous variable in a power plant is its extreme sensitivity to temperature changes. A very slight increase in heat dramatically accelerates those sliding atoms.
And the numbers on this in the source material are just staggering. Padeshia's analysis points out that an operating temperature increase of just 10 degrees Kelvin.
Just 10 degrees.
Yeah, just 10 degrees can reduce the creep life of a steel component by a factor of 2.
It literally cuts the lifespan entirely in half. So a 30-year component suddenly becomes a 15-year component, all because of a 10-degree thermal variance.
Which, I mean, that raises an immediate operational question for me. If a tiny 10-degree fluctuation is that lethal to the plant's lifespan, why not just wire the entire facility with continuous temperature sensors? Like, why do we need a microscopic metallurgical black box if we could just look at a digital thermometer?
Well, you have to consider the sheer scale and the environment. A modern power generation plant is this vast labyrinth of high-pressure pipes, massive turbine rotors, just thousands of critical junctions.
Right. It's huge.
Exactly. Attempting to continuously monitor the exact temperature of every single square inch of those thousands of parts over a 25-year lifespan, it's practically impossible.
Oh, because the sensors themselves would probably break down.
Spot on. In an environment that hostile, thermocouples degrade, sensors drift out of calibration, data acquisition systems just fail. Plus, you know, historical records from 2 decades ago just get lost.
Okay, so you simply cannot trust an external sensor to give you a flawless 25-year thermal history. You have to be able to walk up to a piece of steel today, take a microscopic sample, and let the metal itself tell you exactly what heat stress it's endured.
Precisely. We need to extract the, what they call the integrated time temperature history directly from the material. And to do that, we have to zoom way, way in and look at the steel's initial microstructure.
Okay, let's get into the structure then. The specific materials we are looking at are low alloy steels. So it's mostly iron, some carbon, and a handful of alloying elements added for high temperature strength.
Right, specifically elements like chromium, molybdenum, and manganese.
And the starting structure of these thick components usually consists of a mixture of allotriomorphic ferrite and bainite.
Yes. When these massive industrial components are first manufactured, they are continuously cooled from a very high temperature, which creates that initial ferrite and bainite structure.
Okay.
But here's the catch. You cannot just take that freshly cooled steel and throw it straight into a high-pressure 565-degree operating environment.
Why not?
Because the manufacturing process locks in a massive amount of internal mechanical stress. It would be too brittle.
Oh, gotcha. So the steel has to go through a tempering process first. It basically gets baked at roughly 700 degrees Celsius for several hours just to relax those internal stresses before it ever sees the inside of a power plant.
Exactly. And it's during this tempering process, and this continues throughout its decades of active service, that tiny carbon-rich particles start to precipitate out and evolve inside the steel.
And these particles are called carbides, right?
Yes, carbides. And the specific carbide that acts as our thermal clock is called cementite.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit. So we have these tiny pockets of cementite forming inside the surrounding steel matrix, which is the ferrite. But if we are trying to read a clock here, what is actually ticking? Because, you know, my initial assumption is that the carbon itself is the thing moving around trying to find a balance.
It's actually the exact opposite, surprisingly.
Really?
Yeah. Carbon is a very small atom. It diffuses incredibly fast, almost instantly in the grand scheme of a 25-year lifespan. The carbon equilibrium is reached extremely early on.
Oh, I see.
So the ticking of our clock actually relies on the heavier, slower-moving alloying elements, the chromium, the manganese, and the molybdenum.
Okay, so when the cementite first forms during that initial bainite reaction,
right,
what does its chemical makeup look like?
Well, when it first precipitates, the cementite is far from thermodynamic equilibrium. Its ratio of iron to those alloying elements is basically identical to the surrounding ferrite matrix.
Okay, wait, let me make sure I'm getting this. So you're saying the steel starts out chemically uniform, but because it's hot, it's essentially baking over decades, and certain elements are slowly migrating into these tiny cementite pockets.
Yes, exactly.
It's almost like a sponge slowly soaking up water over 25 years.
That is a perfect analogy, because nature hates a thermodynamic imbalance. The cementite is packed with carbon, so its ideal stable chemical state requires a completely different concentration of chromium and manganese than the surrounding ferrite has.
So it has this massive chemical potential driving it to pull those specific elements in.
That chemical potential is the entire driving force. Over time, fueled by the intense heat of the power plant, those heavier alloying elements literally migrate. They undergo solid-state diffusion, moving out of the surrounding ferrite and enriching the cementite particles.
I gotta say, solid-state diffusion always sounds slightly paradoxical to me. Like, the steel is a solid block of metal. It is not a liquid. How are atoms of chromium physically swimming through a solid crystal structure?
Right. It's not a fluid movement at all. Think of the atomic structure of the ferrite as a densely packed concert crowd.
Okay, I can picture that.
A chromium atom can't just walk freely up to the front of the stage. It has to wait for an empty space, a vacancy in the crystal lattice, to open up right next to it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and when the thermal energy vibrates the lattice enough to create a vacancy, the chromium atom can swap places, inching its way forward.
That perfectly explains why it takes 25 years. It is this painstaking atom-by-atom migration driven entirely by heat.
Exactly.
And because it is driven by heat, if we know the exact mathematical rate at which chromium navigates that crowded concert to reach the cementite, we can just measure the chromium concentration in a sample today.
And then calculate exactly how much thermal energy drove it there.
That is brilliant. But decoding that rate has got to be highly complex, right?
Yeah. It is intensely complex. To read this microscopic clock, we need an incredibly robust mathematical model. We can't just use simple analytical equations because the conditions inside the metal are constantly changing.
Right, and the paper details how Padasci's analysis utilizes what they call a finite difference method to model this diffusion. Why is a finite difference method necessary here? Like, why couldn't metallurgists just use a standard algebraic formula for diffusion?
Because the boundary itself is a moving target.
What do you mean?
Well, as a chromium atom crosses the interface from the ferrite into the cementite, the concentration at the boundary changes. That alters the concentration gradient, which in turn alters the driving force for the very next atom trying to cross over.
Ah, so the math changes with every single atom that moves.
Right. An analytical equation just struggles with continuously shifting boundary conditions over time.
So the finite difference method handles this by essentially slicing up reality into tiny pieces.
Yes, exactly. It takes the microscopic boundary between the cementite and the ferrite and divides it into a microscopic grid of unimaginably thin slices.
Okay.
Then it calculates the flow of atoms across that interface from one slice to the next over a tiny, tiny increment of time. It recalculates the new concentrations, updates the gradients, and then moves to the next tiny increment of time.
So it tracks the exact concentration profile step by step as it approaches equilibrium. That's heavy-duty math.
It is.
And when Padasci ran this intense mathematical modeling, a massive revelation emerged about what actually controls the speed of this clock, right?
Oh, absolutely.
The enrichment rate is heavily dependent on particle size. The analysis showed that smaller cementite particles enrich at a significantly higher rate than the larger ones.
Yeah, it all comes down to the volume to surface area ratio. Smaller cementite particles act as much more efficient sinks for those migrating atoms.
Makes sense.
Because they have a smaller total volume, it takes a much smaller absolute number of migrating chromium atoms to radically shift their overall average concentration. Therefore, a small particle is going to hit chemical equilibrium much faster than a large coarse particle.
But these particles aren't just sitting in isolation, right? They are clustered together throughout the steel. And this introduces a really interesting phenomenon the analysis calls soft impingement.
Soft impingement is a critical hurdle in materials science. When you have multiple tiny cementite particles scattered throughout the steel, each one is actively drawing chromium out of the surrounding ferrite.
They're all pulling at once.
Right. They create a diffusion field around themselves, a localized zone that is actively being depleted of those migrating atoms.
Okay, so if the particles are close together, those depletion zones are going to overlap. Like, they start competing for the exact same pool of chromium atoms. It's kind of like, imagine putting two straws into the same milkshake. At first, you're both getting a lot of milkshake, but soon your suction zones overlap, and you're fighting each other for the remaining liquid, which slows everything down.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. And when those diffusion fields overlap, the concentration gradients become shallower, the driving force drops, and the rate at which the elements flow into the cementite slows down drastically.
So it puts the brakes on the whole process.
It really does. What Padasci's model notes is that for cementite during tempering, this soft impingement happens astonishingly fast, often in less than one single hour.
Wait, really? Less than an hour? So for virtually the entire 25-year lifespan of the power plant component, the clock is ticking under these sluggish, fiercely competitive rules of soft impingement.
Yes.
That alters the entire kinetic curve of the aging process, doesn't it?
It does. Before the diffusion fields overlap, the enrichment of the cementite might follow a kinetic relationship based on time to the power of 1/2.
Which is relatively rapid.
Exactly. But once soft impingement kicks in, the model indicates it shifts to a slower, more protracted curve time to the power of 1/3.
And this shift to a time to the power of 1/3 relationship out to the 1/3 curve, that's a massive headache for an engineer, isn't it?
Oh, huge headache.
Because on a graph, a curve like that flattens out dramatically as time goes on, meaning early in the component's life, the chemistry changes a lot. But near the end of its life, when you desperately need to know if it's going to fail, the chemical changes are moving at an absolute crawl.
Yes, exactly.
You would need unimaginably precise measurements to tell year 24 apart from year 25.
That is exactly the engineering challenge, and it's also why standard metallurgical models failed to accurately predict this in the past. Older models relied heavily on what's called coarsening theory.
What's that?
Coarsening theory assumes a late-stage process where large particles grow at the direct expense of small ones. The big particles essentially cannibalize the small ones to reduce the overall surface energy of the system.
But if coarsening was the primary driver here, the small particles would be disappearing entirely, not enriching.
Right, and that's the key. Hadeshia points out that during this specific approach to equilibrium, the ferrite matrix remains supersaturated with these alloying elements relative to almost all the particles.
Meaning there's still plenty of chromium to go around.
Exactly. The chemical drive to absorb chromium is so overwhelming that all the particles, big and small, they all act as sinks. You cannot base your predictive clock on standard coarsening theory when every single particle in the system is still aggressively absorbing elements.
Just at different speeds based on their size and proximity.
Exactly right.
Okay, so the finite difference model accounts for the shifting boundaries, the particle size variations, the supersaturation, and the rapid onset of soft impingement. It is a brilliant theoretical framework.
It really is.
But, you know, power plant operators don't care about theory. They care about high-pressure steam pipes not exploding. How does this intricate math actually hold up against the gritty reality of an operational power plant?
Well, Hadeshia put the model to the ultimate test by comparing it against some highly rigorous real-world experimental data. This was collected by a research team led by a scientist named Afruz.
Right, Afruz's team. They analyzed a specific low-alloy steel. It was iron with some carbon, silicon manganese, chromium, and molybdenum. But the chemical recipe isn't really what makes this data special.
No, it's the timeline.
Right. This specific steel sample had been an active 565 degrees Celsius service for 70,000 hours.
70,000 hours. That is roughly 8 straight years of relentless, high-temperature, high-stress operational service.
Wow.
It is the absolute perfect real-world proving ground to see if a theoretical microscopic clock actually works.
So when they took the real chromium concentrations from the 70,000-hour steel and laid them over the curves generated by the finite difference model, what happened?
The alignment was remarkable, honestly. The calculated curves from the model showed a very good agreement for the accumulation of chromium in the real-world steel.
But it wasn't perfect across the board. Was it? Like, for molybdenum and manganese, the analysis only calls it a reasonable agreement. Why would chromium track beautifully, but molybdenum and manganese act a bit more unpredictably?
Well, because multi-component diffusion is incredibly complex. These elements, they don't migrate in isolation, they interact with each other.
Oh, I haven't thought of that.
Yeah, molybdenum, for instance, has different affinities, and it might form entirely separate types of carbides, aside from just cementite. And that alters the available concentration in the ferrite.
So they're all competing in the same space.
Exactly. The finite difference model captures the primary mechanisms, but tracking three distinct heavy elements competing in a solid matrix still has slight margins of error.
Still, achieving good agreement on chromium after 70,000 hours of chaotic real-world operation is a massive validation of the math.
It's huge.
But the most revealing part of Afruz's experiment wasn't even just the 70,000-hour sample itself. It was the control group they ran alongside it, which exposed a really critical blind spot.
Yes. Afruz's team took a portion of that exact same 70,000-hour steel, and they essentially reset it. They reheated it to dissolve the structure, normalized it, and created a totally fresh microstructure.
Right.
Then they ran thermal aging tests on this newly reset control sample to compare it against the steel that had aged naturally in the actual plant.
So they have the exact same chemical composition. Both are exposed to the exact same temperatures.
Yeah.
But they did not age the same way. The real world, surface-exposed cementite, changed composition slower than the freshly reheated control steel.
Yeah.
The real world clock was ticking at a different speed.
Yeah.
Why is that?
This is where we see the physical geometry of the microstructure dictate the speed of the chemical clock. The analysis points out that the 70,000-hour steel had a mixed initial microstructure. About 20% of it was bainite.
Okay.
But critically, that specific bainite originally formed from austenite that was heavily enriched with carbon.
Okay, wait. Let's define austenite for a second for the listeners. It's a different high-temperature crystalline phase of the iron that can hold a lot more carbon.
Right. Yes, exactly. And because that specific phase held so much carbon, when it transformed into bainite during manufacturing, the resulting cementite particles were physically different. They were relatively coarse, meaning larger in volume, and they were physically spaced much closer together.
Ah. And based on everything the mathematical model just proved, larger particles enrich much slower because of their volume-to-surface area ratio.
Right.
And on top of that, particles that are closely spaced together suffer from soft impingement, those overlapping diffusion fields we talked about, almost immediately.
Which crashes the enrichment rate.
Exactly. The physical layout of the starting particles acted as a brake on the chemical diffusion. The reheated control steel had a finer, more evenly distributed microstructure, so its chemical clock ticked faster. The chemistry was identical, but the physical geometry was different. Imagine the relief of an engineer who understands this, though.
Mm.
You take a microscopic scraping of a pipe that's been running since the 1990s. You look at the chromium levels in the cementite, check it against this model, and you can say with confidence, we have exactly 3 years of safe operation left.
Right.
I mean, that is practically a superpower.
It really is. It underscores a major conclusion of Badishia's analysis, though. While the finite difference method accurately models the diffusion, we still need further theoretical advancements.
To make it perfect.
Exactly. We have to perfectly integrate simultaneous particle growth, the coarsening alongside the composition changes. We need to map how the physical boundaries are moving while the chemistry is shifting to make these 25-year predictions utterly bulletproof.
Man, it is a stunning piece of scientific detective work. You begin with this massive macro-level industrial problem, a power plant turbine slowly stretching toward failure under extreme heat. You zoom down into the atomic lattice of the steel, tracking the grueling solid-state migration of chromium atoms waiting for vacancies. You model that mathematically, and then you validate it against 8 years of real-world operational data. It just totally bridges the gap between quantum mechanics and heavy industry.
It truly demonstrates the elegance of physical metallurgy. The solution to a structural problem measured in thousands of tons and decades of time is actually found by measuring concentration gradients at the scale of nanometers.
It's incredible. But before we wrap up this deep dive, we have to look at the very end of Badishia's paper. Tucked away in this little section labeled miscellaneous, there is a forward-thinking proposal that entirely flips this paradigm on its head.
Oh, it is a brilliant pivot. Throughout this entire analysis, we have been acting as forensic accountants, basically.
Right.
We're taking whatever standard low-alloy steel happens to be installed in the power plant, and we're painstakingly trying to decipher its accidental thermal history. We're trying to read a clock that was never actually designed to be a clock.
We're just relying on the sheer physical coincidence that chromium migrating into cementite roughly correlates with thermal exposure.
Exactly. But Badishia poses this radical shift in strategy. What if we stopped relying on coincidence? What if we purposefully engineered a diagnostic alloy?
Oh, wow. So like a material synthesized for the sole exclusive purpose of recording its own thermal history.
Think about the possibilities there. You could engineer a specific alloy with a perfectly uniform, predictable starting microstructure. You could tailor the chemistry so that there is a massive, highly sensitive, easily measurable gap between its initial state and its final saturation state.
So no more guessing.
Right. You could even intentionally design the lattice to prevent competing reactions that muddy the data, like what we saw with molybdenum.
It would be a purpose-built internal microscopic black box. Like, you wouldn't build the actual high-pressure pipe out of it. You would just embed a small block of this diagnostic alloy at the critical high-stress junctions of the power plant.
Yep.
It carries no physical load. Its only job is to sit there and age perfectly.
And because it was engineered specifically to be a flawless thermal clock, reading its remaining life would require significantly less mathematical guesswork. The uncertainty of soft impingement and complex initial microstructures, that would all just be designed out of the system entirely. We move from passively observing materials to actively engineering them to communicate their exact degradation to us.
It fundamentally changes our relationship with the infrastructure around us. We spend so much time looking at the macro world, the massive cooling towers, the thick steel pipes, the spinning rotors. But the real secrets to safety, longevity, and predicting the future are written in the invisible atomic migrations of the materials themselves. So something to think about the next time you flip a light switch and rely on a power plant. That invisible current is flowing steadily into your home because somewhere, deep inside a 565-degree furnace, an engineer is reading the microscopic history of steel, making absolutely sure the taffy doesn't snap.